Side 13, The Tommyknockers by Stephen King. Continuing on page 364. Three passes was just about two too many. He had been pretty sure the pilot had spotted the ship and the excavation. The thought had afforded Gardner a strange, bitter relief. Then yesterday, he had seen the story in the paper. You didn't have to be a college graduate to see the connection. Poor old Dr. Bailey had wandered off course, and that leftover from the space armada of Ming the Merciless had stripped his gears. Did that make him, Jim Gardner, an accessory to murder? It might. And wife shooter or not, Gar didn't care for the thought. Freeman Moss, the dour woodsman from Albion, hadn't shown up this morning. Gard supposed the ship had blown his fuses as it had those of the others before him. Gard was alone for the first time since Bobby had disappeared. On the surface, that seemed to open things up. But when you look deeper, the same old conundrums remained. The story of the dead neurosurgeon and the crashed plane had been bad, but to Gard's mind, the story above the fold, the one Newt and Dick had ignored, was worse. The Mideast was getting ready to explode again, and if there was shooting this time, some of it might be nuclear. The Union of Concerned Scientists, those happy folks who kept the black clock, had advanced the hands to 2 minutes to nuclear midnight yesterday, the paper reported. Happy days were here again, all right. The ship could maybe pull the pin on all that, but was that what Freeman, Moss, Kyle, Archenborg, Bosey, and all the rest of them wanted? Sometimes Gard felt a sickening surety that cooling out the powder keg the planet was sitting on was the last thing the new and improved Haven was concerned with. And so? He didn't know. Sometimes being a telepathic zero was a pain in the ass. His eye moved to the pumping machinery squashed into the mud at the edge of the trench. Working at the ship had previously been a matter of dust and dirt and rocks and stumps that wouldn't come up until you were just about half crazy with frustration. Now it was wet work. Very wet work, indeed. The last couple of nights he had gone home with wet clay in his hair between his toes and in the crack of his ass. Mud was bad, but clay was worse. Clay stuck. The pumping equipment was the strangest, ugliest conglomeration yet, but it worked. It also weighed tons, but the mostly silent Freeman Moss had transported it from Bobby's dooryard all by himself. It had taken him most of Thursday and about 500 batteries to do it, but he had done it, something which would have taken an ordinary construction crew a week or more to accomplish. Moss had used a gadget like a metal detector to guide each component to its final resting place, first off the truck, then through the garden, then out along the well-worn path to the dig. The components floated serenely through the warm summer air, their shadows pooled beneath them. Moss carried the thing which had once been a metal detector in one hand, and something which looked like a walkie-talkie handset in the other. When he raised the curved stainless steel antenna on the end of the walkie-talkie gadget and moved the dish at the end of the detector, the motor or pump would rise. When he moved them to the left, the piece of equipment went left. Gard, watching this with the bemusement of a veteran drunk, and surely no one sees as many strange things as one of those, thought that Moss looked like a scrofulous animal trainer leading mechanical elephants through the woods to the site of some unimaginable circus. Gardner had seen the laborious moving of enough heavy equipment to know that this device could revolutionize construction techniques. Such things were outside his practical knowledge, but he guessed that a single gadget, such as the one Moss had used on Thursday with such absent ease, could cut the cost of a project the size of the Aswan Dam by 25% or more. In at least one respect, however, it was like the illusion being maintained at the town hall. It required a lot of juice. "Here," Moss said, handing Gard a heavy pack sack. "Put this on." Gard winced, shouldering the straps. Moss saw it and smiled a little. "It'll get lighter as the day goes along. Don't you worry about that." He plugged the jack of a transistor earphone into the side of the radio controller and pushed the phone into his ear. "What's in the pack?" Gardner asked. "Batteries. Let's go." Moss had switched the gadget on, seemed to listen, nodded, then pointed the curved antenna at the first motor. It rose in the air and hung there. Holding the controller in one hand and the customized metal detector in the other, Moss walked toward the motor. For every step he took, the motor retreated a similar distance. Guard brought up the rear. Moss walked the motor between the house and the shed, urging it around the tomcat and then ahead of him through Bobby's garden. A wide path had been worn through this, but on both sides of it, the plants continued to grow in rampant splendor. Some of the sunflowers were now 12 feet high. They reminded Gardner of the day of the Triffids. One night, about a week ago, he had awakened from a terrible nightmare. In it, the sunflowers in the garden had uprooted themselves and begun to walk, eldritch light shining from their centers and onto the ground like the beams of flashlights with green lenses. There were summer squashes in the garden as big as U-boat torpedoes, tomatoes the size of basketballs. Some of the corn was nearly as high as the sunflowers. Curious, Gardner had picked one of the ears. It was easily 2 feet long. A single ear, had it been good, would have fed 2 hungry men. But Guard had spat out the single mouthful of butter and sugar kernels he had bitten off, grimacing and wiping his mouth. The taste had been meaty and hideous. Bobby was growing a garden full of huge plants, but the vegetables were inedible, perhaps even poisonous. The motor had cruised serenely ahead of them along the path, cornstalks rustling and bending on either side as it pushed its way through. Gardner saw smears and swatches of grease and engine oil on some of the militantly green, sword-like leaves. On the far side of the garden, the motor began to sag. Moss had lowered the antenna, and the motor settled to the earth with a gentle thump. "What's up?" Gardner had asked. Moss only grunted and produced a dime. He stuck it in the base of his controller, twisted it, and pulled 6 AA Duracells out of the battery compartment. He tossed them indifferently on the ground. "Give me some more," he said. Gardner unshouldered the knapsack, undid the straps, opened the flap, and saw what looked at first glance like 1 billion AA's. It was as if someone had hit the grand jackpot at Atlantic City and the machine had paid off in batteries instead of bucks. "Jesus." "I ain't him," Moss said. "Give me 6 of those suckers." For once, Gardner didn't seem to have a wisecrack left in him. He handed 6 batteries over and watched Moss fit them into the compartment. Then Moss replaced the battery hatch, turned it on, refitted the earplug in his ear, and said, "Let's go." 40 yards into the woods, there was another battery change. 60 yards later, another. Floating the motor sucked less juice when it was going downhill, but by the time Moss had finally settled the big motor block on the edge of the trench, they had gone through 42 batteries. Back and forth, one by one, they brought the pieces of pumping machinery from Freeman Moss's truck to the edge of the trench. The knapsack on Gardner's back grew steadily lighter. On the fourth trip, Guard had asked Moss if he could try. A large industrial pump, whose raison d'etre before this odd little side trip had probably been pumping sewage from clogged septic tanks, was sitting on a tilted angle about 100 yards from the trench. Moss was once more changing batteries. Dead double A's lay all along the path now, reminding Guard with odd poignance of the kid at Arcadia Beach, the kid with the firecrackers, the kid whose mother had given up drinking and everything else, the kid who had known about the Tommyknockers.
"Well, you can give her a try." Moss handed over the gadget. "I could use a smidge of help, and I don't mind saying so. Where's a man out lifting all that?"
He saw Gardner's look and said,
"Oh, I'm doing part of it myself. That's what the plug's for. You can try it, but I don't think you'll have much luck. You ain't like us."
I noticed. I'm the one that isn't going to have to buy a set of teeth from Sears and Roebuck when all this is over.
Moss looked at him sourly and said nothing. Guard used his handkerchief to wipe off the brown coating of wax Moss had left on the earplug, then stuck it in his ear. He heard a distant sound like the one you heard when you held a conch shell to your ear. He pointed the antenna at the pump, as he had seen Moss do, then cautiously flickered the antenna upward. The quality of the dim seashore rumble in his ear changed. The pump moved the tiniest bit. He was sure it wasn't just his imagination. But an instant later, 2 other things happened. He felt warm blood coursing down his face from his nose, and his head was filled with a blaring voice.
"Carpet your den or your whole home for less.
screamed some radio announcer, who was suddenly sitting right in the middle of Gardner's head and apparently yelling into an electric bullhorn.
And yes, we do have a new shipment of throw rugs. The last one sold out fast, so be sure. Oh, Jesus, shut up,
Gardner had cried. He dropped the handset and reached for his head. The earphone was dragged out of his ear and the blaring announcer cut out. He had been left with a nosebleed and a head that was ringing like a bell. Freeman Moss, startled out of his taciturnity, stared at Gardner with wide eyes.
What in Christ's name was that?
He asked.
That,
Gardner said weakly,
was WZON, where it's only rock and roll because that's the way you like it. You mind if I sit down for a minute, Moss? I think I just pissed myself. Your nose is bleeding, too.
No shit, Sherlock, Gardner said.
Think maybe you better let me use the lifter after this.
Gard had been more than happy to abide by that. It took them the rest of the day to get all the equipment out to the trench, and Moss was so tired when the last piece arrived that Gardner had to practically carry the man back to his truck.
Feel like I just chopped 2 cords of wood and shit my brains out while I was doing it,
the older man gasped. After that, Gard hadn't really expected the man to come back, but Moss had shown up promptly at 7 the next day. He had been driving a beat-up split-grill Pontiac instead of his truck. He got out of the Pontiac, banging a dinner bucket against his leg.
Come on, let's get to it.
Gardner respected Moss more than the other 3 helpers put together. In fact, he liked him. Moss glanced at him as they walked out to the ship with the morning dew of that Friday morning wetting down the cuffs of their pants.
Caught that one, he grunted. You're okay, too, I guess.
That was about all Mr. Freeman Moss had to say to him that day. They sank a nest of hoses into the trench and rigged more hoses, outflow hoses this time, to direct the water they pumped out downhill on a slope that ran a bit southeast of Bobby's place. These dumper hoses, as Moss called them, were big, wide-bore rolls of canvas that Gard supposed had been scavenged from the VFD.
Ah, got a few there. Got a few other places,
Moss said, and would offer no more on that subject. Before starting the pumps, he had Gardner pound a number of U-shaped clamps over the dumper hoses.
Else they'll go whipping around, spraying water everywhere. If you've ever seen a fireman's hose out of control, you know someone can get hurt, and we ain't got enough men to stand around holding a bunch of pissing hoses all day.
Not that there'd be any volunteers standing in line, right? Freeman Moss had looked at him silently, saying nothing for a moment. Then he grunted.
Pound those clamps in good. We'll still have to stop pretty often to pound them back in. They'll loosen up.
Can't you control the outflow so you don't have to bother with all this clamping shit? Gardner asked. Moss rolled his eyes impatiently at his ignorance.
Sure, he said. But there's one fuck of a lot of water down in that hole, and I'd like to get it out before doomsday if it's all the same to you.
Gardner held out his hand, half laughing.
Hey, I was just asking, he said. Peace.
The man had only grunted in his inimitable Freeman Moss style. By 9:30, water was pouring downhill and away from the ship at a great rate. It was cold and clear and as sweet as water can be, which is sweet indeed, as anyone with a good well could attest. By noon they had created a brand new stream. It was 6 feet wide, shallow, but brawling right along, carrying pine needles, loamy black topsoil, and small shrubs away. There was not much for the men to do but to sit around and make sure none of the plump, straining dumper hoses came free and started to fly around, spraying water like bombed-out fire hydrants. Moss shut the pumps down regularly, in sequence, so that they could pound in loose clamps or switch them to a new place if the ground was getting loose where they had been. By 3 o'clock, the stream was rolling larger bushes downstream, and just before 5 o'clock, Gardner heard the rending rumble of a biggish tree going over. He got up and craned his neck, but it had happened too far down the new stream's course to see.
Sounded like a pine,
Moss said. It was Gardner's turn to look at Moss and say nothing.
Might have been a spruce,
Moss said, and although the man's face remained perfectly straight, Gardner believed Moss might just have made a joke. A very small one, but a joke just the same. Is this water reaching the road, do you think?
Oh, yeah. I should suspect.
It'll wash it out, won't it?
Nope. Town crew's already putting in a new culvert. Large bore. Suppose they'll have to detour traffic a couple of days while they tear up the tarvey, but there ain't as much traffic out here as there used to be anyway.
I noticed, Gardner said.
Damn good thing, if you ask me. Summer people are always a pain in the ass. Looky here, Gardner. I'm going to cut the outflow on these pumps way down, but they'll still pump 15, maybe 17 gallons a minute overnight. With four pumps working, that's 3,800 gallons an hour all night long. Not bad for running on automatic. Come on, let's go. Yon ship's lovely, but it makes my blood pressure jumpy. I'll drink one of your beers before I head home to the missus, if you'll let it be so.
Moss had shown up again yesterday, Saturday, in his old Pontiac, and had promptly run the pumps up to capacity, 35 gallons per minute each, 8,400 gallons an hour. This morning, no Freeman Moss. He had finally played out like the others, leaving Gardner to consider the same old options. First option, business as usual. Second option, run like hell. He had already come to the conclusion that if Bobby died, he would suffer a fatal accident soon afterward. It might take as long as half an hour for him to have it. If he decided to run, would they know in advance? Gardner didn't think so. He and the rest of Haven still played poker the old-fashioned way, with all the cards dealt face down. Oh, and by the way, gang, how far would he have to run to get out of the reach of them and their Buck Rogers gadgetry? Actually, Gar didn't think it would be that far. Derry, Bangor, even Augusta, all those might be too close. Portland? Maybe. Probably. Because of what he thought of as the cigarette analogy. When a kid started to smoke, he was lucky if he could get through half a butt without puking his guts out or almost fainting. After 6 months' experience, he might be able to get through 5 or 10 butts a day. Give a kid 3 years, and you had yourself a 2.5-pack-a-day candidate for lung cancer. Then turn it over. Tell a kid who has just finished his first butt and who is wandering around green-faced and gagging that he has to quit smoking and he'll probably fall down and kiss your ass. Catch him when he's doing 5 or 10 smokes a day, and you've got a kid who probably doesn't care much one way or another. Although a kid habituated even at that level may find himself eating too many sweets and wishing for a smoke when he's bored or nervous. Ah, Gardner thought. But take your smoking vet. Tell him he's got to quit the coffin nails, and he clutches his chest like a man who's having a heart attack, only he's just protecting the smokes in the breast pocket of his shirt. Smoking, Gardner knew from his own mostly successful efforts to either quit the habit or at least damp it down to a less lethal vice, is a physical addiction. In the first week off cigarettes, smokers suffer from jitters, headaches, muscle spasms. Doctors may prescribe B12 to quiet the worst of these symptoms. They know, however, that there are no pills to combat the ex-smoker's feelings of loss and depression during the 6 months which begin the instant the smoker crushes out his last butt and starts his or her lonely voyage out of addiction.
And Haven,
Gardner thought now, running the pumps up to full power,
is like a smoke-filled room. They were sick here at first. They were like a bunch of kids learning to smoke corn shucks out behind the barn. But now they like the air in the room, and why not? They're the ultimate chain smokers. It's in the air they breathe, and God knows what kinds of physiological changes are going on in their brains and bodies. Lung sections show formation of oat cells in the lung tissue of people who have been smoking for only 18 months. There's a high incidence of brain tumors in towns where there are high-pollution milling operations, or, God save us, nuclear reactors. So what is this doing to them?
He didn't know. He had seen no surface observable changes except for the loss of teeth and the increased shortness of temper. But he didn't think they'd chase him very far if he split. They might begin by lighting out after him with the fervor of a posse in a Republic Western, but he somehow thought they would lose interest very quickly, as soon as the withdrawal symptoms set in. He got all four pumps running at top speed, swelling the creek into a wide stream almost at once. Then he began the day's work of checking the U-clamps which held the hoses still. If he got away, his choices were two, keep his mouth shut or blow the whistle.
He knew that for a variety of reasons he would probably keep quiet, which meant simply dealing himself out, writing off the last month of back-breaking labor, writing off any chance to change the suicidal course of world politics at a stroke, most of all, writing off his good friend and erstwhile lover, Bobby Anderson, who had been in absentia for the best part of 2 weeks now. Third option. Get rid of it. Blow it up. Destroy it. Make it no more than another vague rumor, like the supposed aliens in Hangar 18. In spite of his dull fury at the insanity of nuclear power and the energy-swilling technocratic pigs who had created it and underwritten it and refused to see its dangers even in the wake of Chernobyl, in spite of his depression at the AP wire photo of the scientists advancing the black clock to 2 minutes before midnight, he fully recognized the possibility that destroying the ship might be the best thing he could possibly do. The oxidation of whatever had been impregnated in the surface of its hull, deliberately, he had no doubt, had created a cornucopia of mind-blowing gadgets out here. God alone knew what wonderful things might be waiting inside. But there was the other stuff, wasn't there? The neurosurgeon in the crashed plane, that old man and the big state cop, maybe the lady constable, Mrs. McCausland, maybe the two other state cops who had disappeared, maybe even the brown kid. How much of this could be laid at the door of this thing he was staring at, which was jutting out of the ground like the breaching snout of the greatest white whale ever dreamed of? Some? All? None of the above? Gardner was sure of one thing. It wasn't the last. That the ship in the earth was a font of creation was undeniable, but it was also the wrecked craft of an unknowable species from somewhere far out in the blackness. Creatures whose minds might be as different from those of human beings as human minds were from the minds of spiders. It was a marvelous, improbable artifact, shining in the hazy sunlight of this Sunday morning. But it was also a haunted house, where demons might still walk between the walls and in the hollow places. There were times when he would look at it and feel his throat fill up with strangeness, as at the sight of flat eyes staring up at him from the earth. But get rid of it how? Blow it up how? Even supposing he wanted to, how would he do it? The packet charges they had used to chop up the bedrock holding the ship fast were more powerful than dynamite. But they didn't even scratch the hull of the thing. Was he supposed to trot off to Limestone Air Force Base, steal an A-bomb moving with the silky, unbelievable smoothness of Dirk Pitt in a Clive Cussler novel? And wouldn't it be funny, wouldn't it really be the last laugh, if he actually did manage to get a nuke and set it off, only to discover that all he'd really managed to do was to set the ship, still uncannily unharmed and unscratched, free at a stroke? Those were his options, the third of which was not an option at all, and apparently his hands had known more than his brain, for while he went on turning them over in his mind for the umpteenth time, he had gone calmly about the morning's work, driving the pumps up to full blast and making sure that the dumper hoses were solidly planted. Now he was back at the trench checking the sucker hoses and the level of the water. He was happy to find he needed a powerful flashlight to see the water. It was falling rapidly. He guessed that blasting and excavation could begin again by Wednesday, Thursday at the latest. And once they got going again, the work would go fast. The rock of an aquifer was spongy and large poured. They wouldn't need to waste time digging glory holes for explosives, because there would be enough natural spots for not just exploding radios, but satchel charges. The next phase would be like moving from a dense, gluey batter to a freshly risen dough. Guard stood bent over the cut in the earth for some time, shining the big light into the black depths. Then he clicked it off, meaning to inspect the clamps again. Here it was only 8:30 in the morning, and already he wanted a drink. He turned around. Bobby was standing there. Gardner's mouth dropped open. He closed it with a snap after a moment and started toward her, fully expecting this hallucination to grow transparent, then be gone. But Bobby stayed solid. And Guard saw that she had lost a great deal of hair, her brow a pale and shining white, extended back nearly to the middle of her skull, leaving the world's biggest widow's peak in the center.
Nor were these newly exposed sections of skull the only pale things about her. She looked like someone who had been through a terrible, debilitating illness. Her right arm was in a sling, and...
And she's wearing makeup. Pancake makeup. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. She's laid it on heavy, the way a lady does when she wants to cover up a bruise. But it's her. Bobby. No dream.
His eyes suddenly filled with tears. Bobby doubled, then trebled. It wasn't until then, that moment, that he realized just how scared he had been. And how lonely.
Bobby?
He asked hoarsely.
Is it really you?
Bobby smiled, that old sweet smile he loved so well, the one that had saved him from his own idiot self so often. It was Bobby. It was Bobby, and he loved her. He went to her, put his arms around her, laid his tired face against her neck. He had done this before, too. "Hello, guard," she said, and began to cry. He was crying, too. He kissed her, kissed her, kissed her. His hands were suddenly all over her. Her free one was on him. "No," he said, still kissing her. "No, you can't." "Shh, I have to. It's my last chance, guard, our last chance." Kiss. They kissed, oh, they kissed, and now her shirt was unbuttoned, and this was not the body of a sex goddess. It was white and sickish, the muscles flabby, the breasts saggy, but he loved it, and he kissed her, and their tears were all over each other's faces. "Guard, my dear, always, my..." "Shh. Oh, please, I love you."
"Bobby, I love.
Love.
Kiss me.
Kiss. Yes." Pine needles under them. Sweetness. Her tears, his tears. They kissed, kissed, kissed. And as he entered her, guard realized two things at once. How much he had missed her, and that not a single bird was singing. The woods were dead. Kissed.